This is The Guardian.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
As you may have noticed, having moved on from the disaster of the Brexit referendum, David Cameron is enjoying a second political win as Foreign Secretary.
I can get very emotional about it.
This week, he made a visit to Florida to meet Donald Trump, which brought a surprise intervention from the eternally shy and retiring Nigel Farage.
I wish I'd been there at dinner on the terrace at Mar-a-Lago to see this massive slice of humble pie that David Cameron had to eat.
Meanwhile, British foreign policy is in an uneasy and troubled state because of the carnage in Gaza. One huge question sits at the heart of that. Is Israel's place in the world going through a historic shift? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today is The Guardian's political editor, Pippa Creerar, and our diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. So we are going to talk, first of all, about David Cameron's trip to the US and the ongoing discussions around the UK selling arms to Israel. And in part two, we'll speak to Daniel Levy, a former Israeli peace negotiator, who's going to talk to us about the future of Gaza and the Middle East in the midst of the awful scenes we're witnessing from Gaza every day. Let's talk about David Cameron first of all. The former Prime Minister, currently enjoying his second wind as a Foreign Secretary, made a surprise visit, it seemed, to the famous Mar-a-Lago in Florida on Monday night to meet Donald Trump before Cameron made his way to Washington, D.C. It's the first time any senior British government figure, as far as we're aware, has met Donald Trump since he left office in 2021. In a press conference on Tuesday, Cameron, alongside his counterpart, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, was asked about the meeting.
Do you still think that Donald Trump is protectionist, xenophobic, and misogynistic?
Here's Cameron's response.
I've said we had a good meeting. We discussed a range of international issues, but effectively it was a private meeting and one that very much in the precedent of meeting with opposition leaders, obviously in Britain. We respect the electoral process, the democratic process here in the United States, and work with whoever is elected for the benefit of both our countries.
So that was David Cameron there giving the official government line. What do you think is the real reason for this visit, Patrick, first of all?
Well, I think it's a quite sensible move because there's no point preaching to the converted, which is what the Democrats are and what is the White House and the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. The need is to get to the Republicans who are blocking a vote happening in Congress. So what he's trying to do is to put the arguments in a Republican kind of format to persuade them that Ukraine is a US national security issue and not just a European issue. And he's also trying to persuade them that European countries inside NATO are pulling their weight and that the old statistics about how much European countries are spending on defence are out of date and are rapidly changing.
And have you heard or taken any soundings about any signals of success or otherwise in nudging Trump and the Republican Party in that direction?
Well, the biggest public symbol and of success and failure is whether he gets to see the Speaker, Mike Johnson. And there is no sign that is going to happen, although it was something that Cameron had been briefing in advance would happen.
Pippa, tell me what your sense was watching this meeting happen. I mean, obviously, there are sort of awkward vibes swirling around this in the sense that in 2015, I think Cameron called Trump's Muslim travel ban divisive, stupid and wrong. For what it's worth, they were on different sides of the argument as regards Brexit. Trump, as we know, when he keeps the company of British Conservatives, with a small c at least, doesn't pick Cameron types. He's very friendly with Nigel Farage. He seems to be reasonably friendly with Liz Truss.
Yeah, I mean, there's no love lost, or there has been no love lost between the two of them. I mean, you cited David Cameron's views on Donald Trump's Muslim ban travel policy, but he's also in the past described the former president as protectionist and xenophobic and misogynistic. I mean, none of which are likely to have gone down too well in Mar-a-Lago. But I think that the reality of this meeting is that it reflects a sort of anxiety, a broader anxiety that exists across the British government about the prospect of Trump being back in the White House and what that might mean, both for, you know, UK-US relations, but also more broadly about security in Europe. We, of course, last time Trump was in power, threatened to pull out of NATO with all the sort of major implications that would have on security in our part of the world. And his foreign policy advisors have been claiming that if Trump is elected at the next election, he could end the war in Ukraine within 24 hours, made largely by conceding large chunks of Ukraine's territory to Russia, with all the sort of implications that would have in terms of looking like a reward for Russian aggression and potentially encouraging the Putin regime to take action elsewhere. So there's a lot of nervousness, both in terms of the geopolitical sphere, but also for things like trading relationships between the UK and the US, heightened populism that we saw in British politics, partly as a sort of like a knock on from what was going on in the States at the time he was in power. And there's a feeling that they, you know, that relationship needs to be secure, at least, if not a good one.
Let's talk a bit about the issue of arms sales to Israel, which has become a hot political potato of late. David Cameron, while he was in America, confirmed that the UK will not stop arms sales to Israel. This is what he said.
The latest assessment leaves our position on export licenses unchanged. This is consistent with the advice that I and other ministers have received. And as ever, we will keep the position under review.
He also said, so far, this is a quote, no like-minded countries have taken the decision to suspend existing arms export licenses to Israel. And I'd add that Israel remains a vital defensive security partner to the UK. Now, there has been pressure on the government in the UK to stop arms sales on all political sides, it seems. The likes of Lady Hale and Lord Sumption, who were former Supreme Court justices, Lord Soames, Alicia Cairns, the chair of the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Pippa, what have you been hearing about these sort of conflicts within government and the pressure, certainly within the Conservative Party, for some sort of move on arms sales?
Well, what's been interesting is how there has been concern mounting for some time privately among some on the Conservative backbenches and indeed in the House of Lords as well about the legality of some of Israel's actions in Gaza, its response to the October 7th attacks. But it only really bubbled over into the public after that World Central Kitchen attack last week, which resulted in seven aid workers, three of them were Britons, led to sort of more public calls for the UK to stop providing Israel with arms. This is, of course, as you say, cross-party as well, about whether the government should be publishing its legal advice. And what the government says is that there is no precedent for publishing its legal advice if they're going into a conflict situation. So the example that David Cameron gave this week was the Libya incursion, and then, of course, the action in the Red Sea against the Houthis. But there is, of course, a precedent for publishing legal action in other areas. For example, the summary, the advice on the government's Rwanda, controversial Rwanda deportation plan. So the government has resisted publishing legal advice, saying they don't comment on it either. But Cameron said that they want to act in a way that's consistent with it. And number 10 has been at great pains to say that they want to be as transparent as possible. So it's quite difficult for them, on the one hand, to say, well, we're not going to publish it, and we're not even going to publish a summary of it, and we're not going to talk about it, but also we want to be transparent. And that's gotten them pretty badly in its own party, let alone across the aisle with David Lammy, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, suggesting that Cameron's been hiding from scrutiny, and other Labour MPs, not just on the left of the party, concerned about what that legal action might actually say.
Patrick, two questions. First of all, the share of arms sales to Israel, which is accounted for from the UK, is 0.02%. Is it as trifling, therefore, as that number suggests, or should we look at the kind of arms that we're selling? So that, I suppose, is the question of how significant, ultimately, arms dealings are between the two countries. And then also, there's an associated question, which is why, given that small share, is there this ingrained official reluctance to even think about suspending arms sales?
Well, it's true to say that if 0.02% of the total arms sales to Israel comes from the UK and the UK suspended its arms sales, the Israeli Defence Forces will not come grinding to a halt But I think there are parts that we provide to America for F-16s and Apaches that could potentially, you know, have a real-world impact. But I think it's really more in the realm of symbolism that this would be a sign that the UK disapproves of the way in which Israel's conducted itself since October the 7th, and that's the significance in it. The issue is not just arms sales, it's also when you're making a judgment about arms sales, you're having to make a judgment about whether there's a risk of a serious breach of international humanitarian law. And yeah. In there, you're looking at things like proportionality, about the distinctions that are being made between civilian and military targets, but you're also looking at whether humanitarian aid is being delivered in the quantity that it should. And there is a basic theological disagreement between the UK and Israel. The UK says that Israel has a duty as the occupying power to provide humanitarian aid, and Israel says it doesn't have that duty. And that's been a straightforward disagreement between the two sides since January. And a broader point, which I think is really what drives this issue so much, is that basically the government's been boxing and weaving and trying to avoid giving a extended explanation of why it believes Israel is not breaching international humanitarian law. It continually says that Israel must comply with international humanitarian law. It then doesn't say whether it is or is not at present. And what you get is snatches in oral statements, in written answers, when in fact there is a very long, extended discussion going on inside government at a high legal level. And I think, you know, MPs have a right to know what that discussion is about and to weigh the arguments on both sides. And there are arguments on both sides, including self-defense, but there are also arguments about proportionality. And some of those issues have now been aired in a judicial review that's been brought by a couple of NGOs. And it's fascinating to see how the Foreign Office come to its conclusions. Some of the ways in which it comes to conclusions is writing to the Israeli embassy and asking them whether they're complying with international humanitarian law. And oddly enough, they get an answer back that, yes, we are. And then they look at, I think it's 6 or 5 Amnesty International cases which they claim there's been breaches of international humanitarian law. And the Foreign Office say, well, we can't come to a view about those because it's too complicated and we don't have the means to find out whether there has been a breach. Now, you compare that with what happened in 2014 when there was one Prime Minister, David Cameron, and the Business Department, then run by the Liberal Democrats, decided that there would be a suspension of arms sales to Israel on the basis that they didn't know enough to know whether the arms that were being supplied were being used in compliance with international humanitarian law.
Yeah, just pause
law.
There. That's a really interesting distinction, because that was just about an absence of knowledge
exactly. Compared
to what we're faced with now, which is much more brazen and flagrant, arguably. Yeah. Right?
So the point I'm making, there was an absence of knowledge in 2014 which led them to suspend, whilst there's been an absence of knowledge currently, which has led the Foreign Office to the opposite conclusion. So I don't understand how they come to the views they do, except through politics. And I think there is a big political process going on here. I would say that the Attorney General has been involved in this. I think number 10, the Cabinet Office, has been involved in this. And looking at the way in which some of these pieces of advice that have appeared in court and have been sent to ministers, you can see Foreign Office lawyers really working very hard to leave it to ministers to make the decisions.
Pippa, David Cameron has stepped further than his Conservative colleagues in his criticism of Israel, it seems. Much to the annoyance of certain Tory MPs. Last week, Rishi Sunak had a phone call with Benjamin Netanyahu, and the readout that followed that call suggested that his tone was pretty strong. Do you think the government is shifting slightly? I mean, it's, you know, there are rhetorical shifts, and who knows what they're worth as against actual concrete and meaningful moves. But do you think something is going on here?
I think that there is, to me, a clear difference of not just rhetoric, but probably opinion on this right at the top of government. And I think this was exemplified at the weekend when you had both a comment piece from David Cameron in one of the Sunday papers, where he made quite clear that the UK's support for Israel was not unconditional. And took a much more sort of assertive tone, possibly, than either they had before or some in government had. In line, it must be said, with the Biden administration's response, Blinken's sort of stepping up of rhetoric after the World Centre kitchen attack. And then on the other hand, you had the Deputy Prime Minister, Olaf Dowden, who is a man who will, you know, do Rishi Sunak's bidding, going out on the broadcast round and suggesting that Israel was being held to incredibly high standards, higher higher than other nations, and even that some who were pushing the case against Israel were relishing it. And Number 10 had to deny on Monday that that was a reference by Oliver Dowden to David Cameron. So there's a tension there at the top of the government, which however publicly, much they publicly say, oh, well, there's no splits on this, no cabinet splits on this. There's definitely, in my view, a sort of a difference, albeit nuanced, different in approach and tone in the response to some of this.
And is this yet an example of Rishi Sunak's diminishing grip? The fact that you're getting these mixed messages?
I think a lot of this comes down to his relationship with David Cameron, and that applies beyond Israel-Gaza, and the fact that he seems to have outsourced British foreign policy to the former prime minister, who, partly because of his experience in the field, partly because I guess he doesn't have the ambitions to be back in Number 10 himself, it feels like he's basically been given carte blanche to, you know, set the tone and directions, let Rishi Sunak crack on with the domestic issues and the upcoming general election.
Last question, Patrick. There does seem to be a sort of shift across many Western countries as regards rhetoric about Israel and perhaps action that may or may not be taken in the very near future. France's foreign minister, you will know this, has suggested that the international community should impose sanctions against Israel. That's related to Israel's failures, as France sees it, on aid. Do you think something's afoot internationally, which would be, we know, very, very significant?
Yeah, there's an accumulation of frustration and impatience with Israel. And you're also seeing an accumulation of court cases. The International Court of Justice has twice now judged against Israel, and they're now looking at whether Germany is in breach of the law by selling arms to Israel. So there is an accumulation. There was this moment at the UN Security Council a fortnight ago where America finally abstained rather than vetoed a resolution, and that resolution didn't link the release of hostages with a ceasefire. So that was an important moment. And then we've had this froideur between Biden and Netanyahu, which is continuing. The only thing I'd sort of say is to look out for is whether in future Netanyahu realizes he can't go on with this process of basically starving a large number of people in the north of Gaza, and that the amount of aid that is going to go into Gaza is going to be transformed. There is already reports that the number of trucks crossing into Gaza is, you know, doubling. So that will sort of take some of the heat off Netanyahu. It's getting to the point that if he really does want to defeat Hamas militarily, he has to allow more aid in. There's a link between the two. If he doesn't allow the aid in, there's just the pressure on him to come to a deal with Hamas is overwhelming.
For now, let's pause for a moment. Thank you both for joining us, Pippa and Patrick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And when we come back, we'll be speaking to the Israeli peace negotiator and former government advisor, Daniel Levy.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
Welcome back. We're now going to talk to Daniel Levy, who was an Israeli peace negotiator during the Oslo peace talks in the mid-1990s and is now the president of the US Middle East Project, the policy institute which is focused on Israel and Palestine in the context of wider geopolitics. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, John.
I wanted to talk to you because you're really, really familiar with questions about Israel and its place in the world, and it strikes me that Israel is probably at a significant turning point, a very significant turning point in how the world perceives it. There's more pressure coming from the US government, with Joe Biden calling the Israeli approach to Gaza a mistake. And France and other countries are also ramping up the public criticism. So by way of getting into the fundamentals, I wanted to start by asking you this. Could you have conceived of a response to the events of October the 7th that could have been politically satisfactory within Israel, but not looked like this?
Well, first of all,
you cannot begin history on October 7th, John.
Sure, sure.
But we now had a government of such extremity with Ben-Gavir and Smotrich and Netanyahu that the provocations were dialed up to 11, let's say. Now, leaders are supposed to lead. Do you then, in the circumstances of October 7th, go on a journey, which they have gone on, which I think guarantees the next generation of anger, of resistance, of a desire to have revenge, which makes peace, to use that word, so much less likely, which has caused Israel, I think, irreparable damage reputationally, legally, morally, and in many other respects globally, which riles up your population to the kinds of images that I'm sure many people listening to us see coming out of Gaza, the TikTok videos, etc.
Yeah, every hour, or, every day.
Exactly. So, or do you say that we are going to respond? You make that response a targeted response. You go after those who are responsible, and you offer what this should look like. You say this is the military part of the response, and this is how we see things politically going forward, whatever that looks like. Now, the fact that there was none of the latter, interestingly enough, John, has got a lot of attention. As you can imagine, the six-month anniversary in the Israeli media and commentary app, they've been talking a lot about what's the leisure, how's this going, pluses, minuses. And a lot of that commentary from very mainstream people who aren't making the points about the case in the ICJ on genocide that I'm making. But they have said there is an absolute lack of a political plan here. There's no strategy. This was doomed to fail because Netanyahu set up an equation which he could not deliver on.
Is it your understanding that he doesn't have an answer to that question, right? So when he talks about total victory and destroying Hamas, that clearly is no distraction from the fact that he doesn't know where this is going or ultimately what it's meant to achieve. Is it that bad?
It is that bad. And here, you know, I'm certainly not a lone voice in making that argument. Look, I think there's a debate. I don't think it's a particularly serious one as to whether Hamas can be totally destroyed. Hamas is an armed resistance movement. It's also a political movement. It's also an idea. It's based not just in Gaza. So there's still going to be a Hamas. I think it's really easy, John, to kind of focus all this around the person of Netanyahu. And yes, he's been in power for an awfully long time. But on many of these issues, he represents something like a consensus on the Israeli side. And he's perhaps a more effective pursuer of that position than others. But Israel is deeply divided, not ironically, around the question of the Palestinians and the occupation, etc., but is deeply divided, polarized around the domestic and especially legal reforms that he's carrying out. This happens, and Netanyahu, I think, very quickly draws the conclusion that the only way to postpone the who is responsible, how did you let this happen, you must go conversation, is unite people around a forever war, or at least a war that you must keep going as long. Okay. So that's the Netanyahu angle. But I think the broader angle is you do not have a political plan in the Israeli kind of establishment ferment that you can gather any kind of consensus or majority support behind, which offers anything other than variations of more of the same. And I think the unspoken bit is, can we permanently displace the Palestinians from Gaza? How does this become the on-ramp to greater control, less Palestinians, their permanent removal from this space, if you like? And Israeli government ministers openly talked about this.
You made mention of this a moment ago. Do you think most people in Israel see what the rest of the world is seeing? Do you think there's a sense within the sort of body politic of Israel of shock at this sense that global attitudes to Israel are shifting, which you see in, you know, calls for arms sales to be stopped and the French government making noises about sanctions and so on? Do you think that's registering as far as Israeli public opinion is concerned in any way?
So only partially. First of all, the Israeli media has seen part of its role as mobilizing the citizenry, or at least the 80% of Israelis who are Jewish Israeli citizens, behind
this war effort. And they are not showing the images. So, of course, they're accessible. People have phones. But the Israeli media are not really seeing the images that the rest of the world is seeing. Slowly, that is beginning to seep in, that something is going on here reputationally for Israel. Part of that, amongst part of the population, a not insignificant part, is dismissed as, you know, if you like, what do you expect from the Goyim, from the non-Jews? Now, there are fissures and cracks and divisions inside Israel. You do go back to this fault line, which is the anti-Bibi, pro-Bibi camp. And those divisions that existed prior to October 7th are more manifest in the last days than they have been for the last 6 months. The volume, the level, the intensity, the attendance at protests especially. And the way this is playing out in the Israeli debate isn't so much, well, it's not really at all, we must stop doing this to Palestinians, but it crystallizes around something different, which is what priority should be accorded to negotiations for getting out the hostages.
But there's a contrast there, isn't there, between the way the issues of the hostages perhaps is understood by large numbers of people within Israel, what that looks like outside Israel and the wider world, in the sense that now you've got 33,000 Palestinians who have been killed, and you've got all these questions about famine and so on. As awful as the predicament of those hostages are, it looks kind of trifling by comparison to a lot of people, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think one should be able to hold those thoughts simultaneously. You have almost the entire population displaced, four times as many children killed in Gaza as are killed in every conflict around the world in a typical year, according to Save the Children. You have catastrophic hunger levels that have never been recorded before in the 20 years that the UN set up a classification system on food security. You have the destruction of the hospital system, the education system, all infrastructure, all places of worship. And one could go on, and you know, people have seen those images. And the not only the indifference, but the extent of the mainstreaming of that indifference and of calls to genocide. That is a massive disconnect.
What's your sense of if these noises of unease, which may or may not soon sort of take the form of outright opposition to what Israel's doing, what's your sense of when that might start to make Israel stop and listen, if that will happen at all? Do you think Israel worries about it?
I think there is some worry. I think it really depends what the extent of it is. So, first of all, let's acknowledge that it's a small cohort. It's an important cohort. It's where Israel draws certainly its weapon supplies and other things from. But it is a small cohort and a shrinking cohort of countries that are still giving Israel the backing, the leeway, the support to continue this. Even in the global north, where we are, in amongst Israel's Western allies, you see a very significant divide in most places between where public opinion is at and where the political elites are at. However, the key thing, how will those political elites act? I would argue that the way that this begins to percolate and force a hard choice on Israel's political leaders, Israel's military leaders, the way it impacts public opinion, is if that key piece of leverage is deployed, and the one that has to deploy it is the United States, and that is the conveyor belt of weapons, because it's very clear, and it's been said in the Israeli press, without that, Israel cannot continue these actions in Gaza.
Okay. That seems less than likely right now, though. You will agree with that. The idea that there would be any sort of American suspension of arms sales seems for the birds, does it?
At the moment, despite everything, you still have the president refusing to do that. They have spoken, especially, and it shouldn't have taken this. Of course, what the World Central Kitchen folks are doing there is very courageous, but really it shouldn't have taken that particular incident to lead to a questioning of how much longer at this level can the support continue. The extent, the level of British arms exports is not the point. The point is, what kind of pressure builds up on the US? Can the US turn around and say, all our allies are in the same place? And it was a shameful display in Washington by the foreign secretary in teeing up precisely the wrong response. in his commitment that Britain was in the sweet spot of consensus by continuing to arm what is plausibly a genocide.
How seriously do you take what we seem to know about the so-called Biden peace plan, which is based on a rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia, substantial steps towards Palestinian statehood, and what the American government, I think, calls a revitalized Palestinian Authority, whatever that means, running Gaza? There's the question about those proposals specifically, and there's an even bigger question, I suppose, which is how you construct anything resembling sustainable peace out of conditions as awful as the ones that we're faced with. That's a huge question, because I'm not alone in this. I'm sure I watch the news every night and think, how on earth do you construct anything out of this?
The sad thing is that there is even less to this than meets the eye, and you used an expression earlier in our chat, John. You said, well, surely that's for the birds. And so I'll use that back. This is so lacking in seriousness that it's almost tragic. And again, I think to understand the dimensions of this failure, let's just go back to October 6th. What was the Biden administration policy? What was Jake Sullivan, his national security advisor, writing in Foreign Policy in a big think piece? This is the most peaceful the Middle East has been for decades. The Biden administration was carrying on as if the Palestinian issue could just be kicked into the long grass, we'll do more normalization. What it actually amounts to is an attempt to refreeze the October 6th status quo ante, which is a peace process that is nothing other than a Potemkin cover for what those countries and organizations have described as an apartheid reality. And if you're serious about this, there is no Hail Mary pass to go for this. You need to do the hard work of the building blocks. And those begin not with a Palestinian Authority that is revitalized by the West to serve American and Israeli interest. It begins with letting the Palestinians establish their own terms for how they want to move forward. And it's not easy to acknowledge. I don't expect anyone to embrace this, but that will have to include Hamas. The impunity, the absence of holding Israel accountable, I would say has done huge damage to the ability for Israelis to wake up from this hangover and to actually guarantee their own security, because it will not be secured this way. Of course, the Palestinians will have the most rotten time of it as long as we carry on down this path.
Okay. Seeing as we're both in Britain, I mean, this may seem a sort of parochial question in comparison to most of what we've talked about, but all of this points to a question about whether the place of Israel in British foreign policy inevitably is going to shift as a legacy of this. Because there's a sort of generational question here, right? Which for a lot of people who might be on all sides of politics, this is going to be proved to have been quite a formative political experience, right? Notwithstanding the fact they're not directly involved in the horror of it, but just seeing it on your phone every hour of every day, you're aware that you're in the midst of something huge and significant and horrific, and that will have political consequences within British politics. Things are going to change, aren't they?
I'll be honest with you, that's something I'm asking myself as well. How is this going to look? I think that Palestine, as almost an avatar of the injustice we see everywhere, but here it is so in our face, the disconnect between the verbiage of the political class and what members of the public see all the time. I think that disconnect is so huge. The double standard, the hypocrisy, the what are you talking about, man, when you say that we share their values? And the attempt to describe these marches as hate marches, these marches essentially for a ceasefire. So I think that we are in this place, which I think is a dangerous place to be in, by the way, especially if none of the main political parties are offering something, which it doesn't have to be extreme, but it can be aligned with international law. It can be aligned with where the public is at. How this plays out in the months and years ahead, and how that recalibration of ultimately UK policy, I think that could end up mattering a great deal, because I think the greatest disservice we can do to Palestinians and Israelis alike is to pretend that this is normal and this is okay and go back to doing what you were doing.
Okay, last question. How are you in the midst of all this? I ask you that because for the most part, in a country like Britain, one can treat politics relatively dispassionately, right? Particularly if you're a political journalist, if you do what I do, but reasonably frequently it has an emotional effect. But nothing will have an emotional effect like the kind of thing that we're seeing day in, day out. And I just wonder, for you, given your background, working at the absolute centre of Israeli affairs and Israeli government, what this feels like.
I'm focused a lot of the time on what are the interventions, what are the private messages, what are the talking points. But fine, park that. I'll be honest, I swing mood-wise quite madly between the deepest despair and hope that this has to now change things. There are, and I believe there are openings. It's a deeply despairing time. I'll share one thing with you. When South Africa, and it was very powerful that it was South Africa, and if you saw that their legal team, when South Africa brought this case to the International Court of Justice on the Genocide Convention, I spent that day listening to that testimony crying, that this is where we've gotten to, that a convention established under those circumstances, after the Shoah, the Holocaust, after the Second World War, was now being brought to the court because of things Israel was doing. And that was an incredibly powerful moment for me. But I have taken such encouragement that, you know, whether it's Jonathan Glazer at the Oscars, whether it's Jewish Voice for Peace in the US taking over Grand Central Station, whether it's people in Na'amod, British Jews Against Occupation and Apartheid in this country, that vital conversation that needs to take place in my community, the Jewish community, it's not easy. And I'm not saying we're anywhere near the majority, but that conversation, I think, is increasingly unavoidable. And that gives me some solace in the hardest times that I've live through to not want to be overly dramatic.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. Before you go, make sure you listen to our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, where this week Jonathan Friedland speaks to the former Middle East negotiator Aaron David Miller about why criticism from within his own party has forced Joe Biden to put pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu, and whether Israel's war in Gaza has forever changed the relationship between the US and Israel. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.